G'day Groovers, welcome to another installment of The U Project. My name is Craig Harper. I hope this finds you well. So today's episode is a little different. I was recently on Bobby Cappuccio's podcast, which is called The Self-Help Antidote. Most of you know Bobby, my brother from another mother. He's a little bit weird. He's a little bit brilliant. We love him here at The U Project. And he's just kicked off his own pod, which, as I said, is called The Self-Help Antidote. So maybe go give him a follow. You can find him on iTunes and Apple and Tiff, help me out. What else?
Spotify and CastBox and Radio, iHeartRadio and all the places.
Thank you. Thank you. All those other places. He's a ripper. And if you feel in your heart to go and give him a five-star rating, once you listen to an episode or two and you think it's ace, do that. Also, while you're handing out five-star ratings, if you feel compelled to give us a little bit of a leg up here at The U Project, how do they do that, Tiff?
Go to that purple app on their iPhone hearts. They scroll down when they get to your show till they hit the five stars. And then a little bit under that, there's an option to write a review and they can just pour their hearts out.
Oh, that'd be great. No pressure, no expectation, but it's just something amazing. That'd be great. Now, I recorded this interview a week or a week and a half ago, and I'm going to be honest, I can't really remember what we spoke about, but I think, because Tiff, you did the editing, but I think we spoke a little bit about my backstory and my journey and how I ended up doing the stuff that I'm doing. One of the questions I get asked a lot is how do you become a speaker, or how did you become a speaker, or how do you get in front of groups and audiences, and how does all of that work? And the truth is there is no set path. I think there are a million different paths for people to get into, you know, all that, the more broadly speaking, behavioral psychology, self-help, personal development. And for me, it's been via radio and newspaper and blogs and podcasts and corporate speaking and working with teams and athletes and owning gyms. It's been a multifactorial kind of thing. It hasn't been about a single thing, but many things. But we kind of open the door on that conversation and talk about, both of us talk about kind of where we've been and what we've learned along the way. So as far as I can remember, I think it was you actually sent me a message and said it was a really good podcast. We should share it. And I went, was it?
Yeah, it really was, Harps. Really was.
All right. Well, here we are. Without any further ado, folks, I hope you're having a great day. Hope you're walking your talk and doing what you need to do to get where you want to go. Tiff, thanks for jumping on momentarily and recording this for me. And see the rest of you next time. And I hope you enjoy our version of Bobby's podcast, The Self-Help Antidote, here on The U Project. Love your guts.
Welcome, Craig Harper.
Hello, Robert. Hello, Barbie. How are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you feeling today?
I'm good.
What's tomorrow where you are?
Well, it's actually 5 years ago where I am. some say that. Yeah, it's good
to get into
that. It's Saturday. It's 1 o'clock in the thriving metropolis of Melbourne, and life is good. And we're in considerable less. Or we're under considerable less restrictions than you are right now. So I'm sorry about where you guys are at, but hopefully you turn the corner very quickly.
Well, outdoors are open now. So there's people sitting in chairs in the rain. It's picking up. It's looking positive. So
I was just going to say, what's the kind of, you're in San Diego. What's the median temperature there? Like what is it? It's because it's winter, obviously. We're in the middle of summer. You're in the middle of winter. What's a normal day for you,
temperature-wise? I reckon it was about 8 degrees this morning.
Oh, wow.
A rainy, cold 8 degrees.
Now, is that Fahrenheit or Celsius?
No. That's Celsius.
Right.
I'm just speaking to you in your Aussie language. So
it's very good how you adapt that very quickly because you've lived in so many places.
It's my empathy. I consider the person who I'm speaking to.
Yeah, you like that. Well, congratulations on the podcast. I'm honored to be one of the first few guests. And
you are one of the first few guests.
Let's see where we go, my friend.
So, yeah, I don't know if everybody knows you. I would assume they do, but maybe one or two might not. So you have like one of the top rated podcasts in the world right now. You are pre-COVID, internationally renowned speaker. Right now you're an internationally renowned coach, but you weren't always a coach extraordinaire, were you, Craig? So take us back. How'd you get started on this path?
I wouldn't say I'm internationally renowned either, but thanks. That sounds, are we allowed to swear on this?
Nah, absolutely not.
Okay.
I've got a reputation.
It sounds interesting. It sounds amazing. I think like a lot of people who come from, I would say my background was typical, you know, mediocre. I was a fat kid. There are a bunch of fat kids I know. I was a fat kid. I was average at school. I was average at sport. I was average at relationships. I grew up in the country. I wasn't a genius in anything, but, I was always fascinated with humans and human behavior and thinking. And by the time I was 14, I was a morbidly obese kid. So in your language, I was over 200 pounds. In mine, I was over 90 kilos at 14 and not particularly tall at that stage, probably 5'5". You know, and like a lot of people, had a moment in time that was a bit cathartic and a bit transformational, where I just had a really uncomfortable, unpleasant moment that for me was a catalyst, was a bit of a light bulb to change my operating system. So in a short period of time, I lost all the excess weight. I lost probably 30 kilos, maybe 32 or three, maybe 65, 70 pounds.
It's a lot of weight.
Yeah, in about 15 weeks, and started running and started training and started just moving my body rather than just living on cake and cookies, which apparently is not optimal.
Hold on though. You said that, you know, you were an average kid living an average life. Everything was pretty average. You know, like you lost a ton of weight in a span of 15 weeks.
Yeah.
What happened just before that?
So what happened just before that was, I feel like I've told this story too many times, but maybe for your audience not. So, I mean, I think a lot of transformation is preceded by an event. I call it an emotional or a psychological tipping point. Something happens, someone has an experience, a light bulb moment, an encounter, a moment in time, a tragedy, whatever it is, it's some kind of internal catalyst that precedes the external behavioral change and then the results, you know. But for me, it was just year eight swimming sports. And I grew up in a very sporting area in the country. Everyone played sport, everyone swam, everyone ran, everyone played football, everyone played basketball, netball, cricket, everybody participated. I was not at all athletic or sporting. And so for me, there was a skill to avoid having to wear bathers in public and to reveal the ampleness of my body at that stage. So we had compulsory swimming carnivals and everything, compulsory sports and all of that stuff. The good thing about sport day is I could throw a javelin or throw a shot put or throw a discus and be fully clothed, and nobody had to see particularly anything much particularly. But with the swimming sports, you know, the idea of standing on a starting block in front of hundreds of children, hundreds of parents, teachers, friends, family, and probably collectively 1,000 or more people. For me to stand on a starting block in what we call here bathers or swimmers was the last thing I wanted to do, like the absolute last. Like I did not even like looking at myself with no clothes on.
So for you, it wasn't that you just lost a ton of weight in 15 weeks. There was a strong emotional impetus that pushed you in that direction.
Yeah. Well, for me, I was completely, and I don't blame anyone. It was my fault. I created it. So there was no real self-pity. There was just this anguish of, I never want to feel this again. I never want to feel that embarrassed again. I never want to feel that uncomfortable again. I never want to be that. I never want to be the center of attention for that reason. Like there was eight kids on starting blocks and probably no one was particularly examining me, but it just felt like nobody was looking at anybody else except me. And that's purely just, you know, a construct of my 14-year-old mind. I know that now, but at the time, I just felt like the fattest human being in the world, and I couldn't get off those blocks and into the water quick enough and out of the water and somewhere else quick enough. And so, you know, I think for a lot of people that emotional and psychological leverage can be the start of something big and great and beautiful and transformational if we use it the right way. And so I still, you know, my name through school was Jumbo. Parents called me Jumbo. Kids called me Jumbo. Teachers called me Jumbo. Coaches called me Jumbo. Very few people called me Craig other than my family.
And that was very painful for you.
Yeah, well, you know, it kind of was and it wasn't, if I'm being honest, but it was, put it this way, your what everybody calls you is essentially a representation of your fat body. So outwardly, I was okay with it. Inwardly, I didn't love it because it's essentially a label of your obesity. And it's kind of a friendly, hey, Jumbo, it's kind of friendly, but at the same time, it's an acknowledgement of what you're walking around in, which is this obese physique. So yeah, it was painful, but the irony is that my friends called me that. Mm-hmm. And I also know that there was no ill will. I also know that they loved me. My best mate called me that and he loves me and I love him. You know, so that was the irony of kids growing up in the country. And so when new kids would come, nobody would meet Craig. Everybody would meet Jumbo.
So, you know, so it was just banter. And for them, it was a term of endearment. And psychologically, it sounds like you got that. But intrinsically, 14 years old, you're clearly aware of your body. And let's be honest, at 14, we're becoming aware of bodies in general. And for you, that was the impetus. You channeled that. You even said something to the effect of, you know, if you use it correctly, you know, I want to get back into your journey in a second, but a lot of people feel that. A lot of people feel that pain. A lot of people feel self-conscious and they channel it, but they may not channel it into a constructive medium that moves them forward. And sometimes the way they channel it keeps them stuck. What goes wrong? What's the difference between what happened with you, you know, moving forward, now coaching people, you know, all over the world, and other people who find themselves a bit stuck in that same situation?
Yeah, I think perhaps, you know, it's having an awareness in the moment that this is a moment in time for me, and I have a choice as to how I respond. And this is, you know, this is the theory. And of course, the theory is not the reality and it's much easier said than done. But I think that moments, good and bad, painful, catastrophic, you know, predicted, unpredicted, I think moments in time can be platforms for beautiful things. Even painful things can be platforms for beautiful things. You know, and COVID for me and for most people, you know, we're coming out the other side in Australia and I'm really thankful, but like many people, my business totally fell over and I lost hundreds of thousands of dollars in a couple of weeks. And for about three days, I walked around with my bottom lip hanging out, feeling sorry for myself and being a little bit anxious, but you know, the thing was that actually once something has happened, once you've swum the race and stood in front of the crowd in your fat body, or once COVID's arrived, or once the illness arrives, or once that whatever, that catastrophe, that problem, you know, once it's there, it's there. And then I think the challenge for us in the middle of the emotion of the pain or the fear or the resentment or the anxiety is to find a little bit of space between that feeling and the response and say, all right, so this moment in time is really important. And I don't know that I was that cognitive when I was, you know, reacting to the swimming experience, but I definitely realized that I was the captain of my own ship and the master of my own destiny. And I also realized that I was fat because of my own behavior. I realized that. I acknowledge that.
I just want to stop you right there only because you're saying a lot of poignant things and I just don't want to miss anything. Three things that are showing up for me right now is number one, people a lot of times, I know that's a broad brush, people, but in general, this does happen where we project the pain that's going to happen through a certain course of action in the future, or we may have self-doubt. So what if I put all this effort in? And I'm still not any better off. You are acknowledging the situation I'm in right now is a situation that might be the most painful part of the journey, is being stuck in this position. So I've already experienced the worst pain that I could possibly experience. The second thing is we get caught because we are emotional creatures. We get caught in reaction. And you're saying just sit in it for a moment, you know, like when COVID hit, there was a couple of weeks there where you just sat in it and then you figured it out. So realize the pain that you're in might be the greatest amount of pain that you're going to suffer through. So it's not as precarious moving forward as you think it might be. Sit in that for a second so you don't find yourself in a non-constructive emotive response to your situation. And the third thing is taking 100% responsibility. I am crossing this chasm from where I am to the direction I'm headed no matter what, and I'm responsible. So those are three things I'm pulling out of what you just said, just to make sure that I'm tracking.
No, you're exactly right. And I think there's another layer, mate, and that is, you know, we live in a culture, a collective culture and mindset that, you know, sometimes, especially in the personal development, and you and I, ironically, are a little bit dubious about personal development and self-help in the traditional sense. And there's this kind of ever-present and underlying theme that you can be what you want to be and do what anything you want to do. And, you know, life's a fucking Disney movie. And I know that's not a lot of people, but it is for, you know, some of the
messages. I tried to be 6'4" when I first heard that. I was very disappointed with the outcome.
Yeah, it didn't happen. Yeah, me too. I tried to run 100 in 9 seconds. It didn't happen. But I mean, the practical reality of life is that life is messy. Life is unfair. Life is also beautiful and glorious, but there are times where life is a shit fest of pain and tragedy and unfairness and all of these things. And, you know, the challenge for us is not to make our external world awesome. Our challenge for us is to be able to internally and behaviorally navigate our world. So I'm not pretending that things are great when they're not. I'm not pretending. I'm acknowledging what is. I acknowledge that I don't have awesome genetics. I acknowledge that COVID is here. I acknowledge that that is a problem. I acknowledge that, you know, my mum's had cancer 3 times in the last 7 or 8 years. I don't pretend she doesn't have cancer. I don't put my head in the sand. I don't, you know, I acknowledge what is. I go, that shit, we don't want that. I wish it wasn't happening. It's terrible. It's tragic. However, it's happening. Now, what do we do? Now, what decisions do we make? How do we communicate with mum, support mum, love mum? Do I talk to the surgeon? Do I go with her to the doctors? How do we self-manage in the middle of this undesirable situation? How do I create the best outcome? And I think, you know, the challenge for us, especially I'm assuming most people on this call are grown-ups, you know, is to acknowledge the bullshit and acknowledge the messiness of life and but also then to go, now I need to step up, look up and take responsibility for my behaviors, my reactions, my responses, my words, my attention, my focus and my energy moving forward so that despite this shit, I can at least move in a positive direction.
Well, first of all, I'd like to dispute something you said. I highly disagree with you not having great genetics. You're a phenomenal specimen. And
you're exactly. Hilarious. Anyone who's watching this on YouTube knows that that's a lie.
I'm going to get some emails on. Actually, you know, this is totally tangential, but I've gotten, like you say, from people all over the world. Granted, not a lot of people, but there've been like one or two females that are like, oh yeah, I find Craig Harper extremely attractive.
You're a fucking liar.
I am dead serious. They're probably listening to this right now, like figuring out a stalking strategy. They could be hiding in the bushes outside your house in 3 weeks, guaranteed. Mm.
All right, move on.
So anyway, that was a little bit weird. your story is also reminding me of Jim Collins, the book Good to Great. There was a lot of salient points in there, but one was where he was talking about Admiral James Stockdale. And this is going back to like 1992. I don't even remember 1992, but Ross Perot was running for president of the United States. He was like this billionaire back when like there were very few billionaires. And he's running mate was Admiral James Stockdale. And Jim Collins was on this campus of Stanford University. And he heard Stockdale was speaking there. Now, Stockdale had written a book called In Love and War, which is an account of his story as a POW at the Hanoi Hilton. And he was extremely excited to talk to him. And he was lecturing there as well. And they both had very limited time. He said, can I just walk with you to like your session and chat? And he was just basically asking, like, how do you survive? He was he was in prison for, I think, 8 years and brutally tortured over 20 times. And he said, well, what got you through that? And Stockdale said, I mean, you probably know the story. He said that I had this unwavering belief, this faith that I was going to make it. And it, like, we're used to hearing that. So Jim Collins like, wow, that's fascinating. He said, well, what about the people who didn't make it out? And they said, oh, that's easy. They were the optimists. And now Collins is completely confused because he's like, wait, you just said that you had this unwavering belief that you were going to make it out, but then you cite optimism as the main reason why people just didn't survive that experience. Clear this up for me. I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around this. And he said, well, basically, I knew no matter what happened, we were going to go home at some point. But I also knew the brutal reality of how hard the road ahead was going to be. And there was like this date people had in their mind, like, oh, Christmas, we'll be rescued by Christmas. Christmas came and went. And it was like, okay, next year, Christmas. Christmas came and went again. And people just gave up hope. And their bodies literally gave out and they died. And Collins wrote about this as the Stockdale paradox, which is the unrelenting belief in your ability to persevere. Mm. And at the same time, being brutally honest about the facts of reality.
That's right. Yeah, that's so important. And that is really, you know, and another kind of an extension of that is when we keep getting disappointed in other people because we think they will behave a certain way. And so we're expecting them to respond or to talk or to be a certain way. And that's not about what they do. It's actually about our expectation of what they do rather than, you know, I was talking to a lady recently and she was telling me that her son constantly disappoints her because he doesn't matter. He's got a challenge, but he does this thing and she wants him to do the opposite. You might guess what it's about, right? But anyway, it's about a behavior. It's about drugs. Nobody knows who he is or she is, but we were talking and he keeps doing all of these things that are self-destructive and hurting the family and all that. And I said, look, I mean, we want to be positive, but we want to be practical. You know, this could take 3 months, this could take 3 years. And your expectation that he will do what you think he should do tomorrow is actually the main source of your frustration. And I'm not saying we're cheering on his using and we're cheering on his lifestyle, but if he's done something, if he's let you down 500 days in a row, there's a fair chance today will be the same. Now, it's not that we don't hope. It's not that we don't work. It's not that we don't support and encourage. We do. We do everything we can to get where we want to go and to survive and thrive and stay in a good place mentally and emotionally. But he's going to change when he's going to change. You know, I think that you know, very much about that guy you were talking about, which is where he is also going, well, we could be out in a week. We could be out in a decade. Either way, I don't have any control of that, but I have control of me. Mm-hmm. So,
and yeah, easier said than done, but yes, essentially right.
Exactly. Easier said than done.
And it's amazing how many times that I've done a seminar on behavior change and you have the group of people at the end that are waiting around to ask questions and you're chatting with them. And invariably, there'll always be one person in that group and their question is in the form of, how do I get people to do what I expect of them and listen to me? And that is, it's almost like reframe the question, what can I do to guarantee my perpetual frustration and misery in life? Because that's essentially what you're asking. I'm not saying we don't hold expectations, because there's another paradox with expectancy where I used to apprentice under this public speaker. And he said that if you want to improve your life dramatically, expect more of yourself and much, much less of others. And I don't mean you shouldn't expect people to have basic human courtesy. Like, you know, you don't light up a cigar in a closed room of non-smokers. You know, you don't run through a red light. You know, there's certain things we need to expect from each other out of society. That's a poignant topic lately that I'm not even going to touch. But so there's that bare minimum of expectancy. And then you have Jacobson and Rosenthal in San Francisco school districts back in the 1960s, where a level of expectancy actually drove performance significantly with a group of students within that experiment. But that's only if people are in on the deal. If I am giving you permission to influence me and there is mutual investment that we have, if I'm not invested in going where you want to take me, your expectations, if anything, are going to push me in the other direction. And it's for you on the receiving end of that, the one that's holding that expectation, that's brutal.
Yeah. Well, that question that you get asked, I get asked all the time as well. And that's, in fact, I did a gig on Thursday night here two nights ago, one of my first in public events, and and nobody knows who they are, so I can say, but a mum and dad came up, and they have a daughter who is needs to get in shape. We'll just say that she needs to look after her health, and you know she's not in a great place physically, and their question started with how do we make our daughter blah 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 blah, and I went, you don't mm-hmm. because and even though their intentions are great and even though they love her and even though they'll support and provide resources, and I said, she needs, how old is she? And she's not a woman, but she's not a child, you know, she's late-ish teens. And I said, you know, she needs to get to that place where she's ready to do the work, and she has that revelation. She has that light bulb. She has that drive. She has that desire mm-hmm. because, you know, it's an understandable question, especially when we love someone and we see that someone doing something that in our opinion is self-destructive or deleterious, or over time it's going to damage them in some way, or we believe it will. And, you know, but we tell ourselves, yeah, but I love her, I love him, and this is, I care, and this is why I'm doing it. And I'm coming from a place of compassion and concern. And yep, get it all. I get it all. I did the same thing with my mum, who, my mum smoked when she was younger. And when I was literally probably 12 or 13 years old, I badgered my mum to stop smoking. And I badgered her she probably stopped when she was about 50, but I probably badgered her for about 20 years. And all it did was create problems, because every time, and the only reason I wanted her to not stop were the obvious reasons. I love my mum. I want my mum to live. I don't want you to die. And all it did was piss her off, create disconnection, and things would be a bit rocky between her and I for a few days. Mm-hmm. And it, because she didn't want that message, despite the fact that the message was real and authentic and legitimate and relevant and potentially helpful, it didn't matter. And that's, I think that's why, you know, this idea of, it's not that I don't care about others. Of course I care about others, but even like what you and I do, we coach, we share thoughts and ideas and strategies. We go into a room, we get on a podcast, we get on a Zoom call, and then you do your thing. I do my thing, and I share thoughts and ideas and strategies and stories and encouragement and inspiration and motivation and love and connection. Hopefully that's what I'm doing. But at the end of the day, that's the end of it for me. I can't get out of bed for anyone. I can't be disciplined for anyone. I can't make decisions for anyone.
You can hold space, be resilient, and extend an invitation.
That's it. And I go, you know, even the other night I did this 2-hour workshop that I was talking about, and I essentially say, you know, at the end, put up your hand if you're a bit motivated or a bit more inspired, or you know, and everyone puts up their hand, and I go, well, that'll pass. I go, that'll pass. And 95% of what I said tonight, you won't remember tomorrow. And in a week or two, you might not even remember what my name was. And I said, I'm glad that you had a good night, and I'm glad that we had some connection and some laughs, and I hope it was a good experience, but really, I don't care that much. What I really care about is what happens now. What happens next? Because really, for me as a coach, for you as a coach, my ability to share thoughts and ideas and stories is not bad. It's my job. It's what I do. I'm not amazing, but I'm not bad at it. It's my job. I've been doing it for a long time. But what I care about is not, can I stand in front of a group and be articulate and clever and entertaining and engaging? I want that. But what I really want is the consequence is, and I hope the consequence is that people buy into what we're talking about and they have their own moment of revelation and inspiration, and not because of Craig Harper, but because of that thought or that idea. It's never about me. It's about the truth of what we're sharing. And then hopefully they're going to take that, do something with that, and then they will create the transformation. You know, I get really annoyed. I'm getting on a soapbox, but I get really fucking annoyed with people who, and I said this on a podcast recently, coaches and mentors who say, I change people's lives. Mm. I want to punch them in the face
I'm glad you're talking about this.
I go, no, you don't. You don't fucking change lives, because you're not doing any of the work. You, at very best, you might inspire, encourage, or educate a few people. But
you're not fucking Harry Potter.
Yeah. You taking credit for what people do in their life is the biggest act of, or the biggest display of ego of all time. So shut the fuck up, be humble. Stop telling people how awesome you are, and be the humble servant and teacher, and go out, encourage, support, and love people, and then they'll do the work or they won't. But that's not about you.
I mean, it was a brilliant soapbox to get on, because again, this is the whole reason behind the self-help antidote. I don't have a problem inherently with self-help. I have a problem with unexamined ideas that are not substantiated either anecdotally and especially empirically. And that's one of the things that we're talking about, because even if you could, by sheer force of will, your will is greater than that of your client, which is a disturbing concept in and of itself. But even if that was the reality, if you cared about your client at all, you would not want to change their life, because then they don't get the capacity. They don't get the increase in self-efficacy, which is their internal belief and their ability to take and sustain actions that are aligned with what they truly want. They increase their belief in you, the coach. That doesn't help self-efficacy. And without self-efficacy, there is no enduring transformation. And that does not allow cognitive dissonance, meaning when you have two opposing ideas at the same time causing duress, and you drive to maintain consistency between what you are saying and doing now with what you'll say and do in the future, you don't get to leverage that on their behalf, because it was not their strategy. It wasn't, as you said earlier, the word that stuck out was revelation. It was yours. So if it works, congratulations, coach. That does nothing to shift my perspective or my capacity internally. And if it doesn't work, I don't get to learn from that and go, okay, well, why did that not work? It's like, okay, well, what now, coach? So you completely incapacitate somebody if you're in the driver's seat. Coaching and teaching are two totally different things. I think they're both equally valuable within their respective context, but they're not the same. One puts things in, the other is meant to draw things out. So yeah. I love that soapbox that you got on. You know, I just realized, like, the both of us, surprise, surprise, we're on a massive tangent. We haven't even gotten to how you went from this 14-year-old kid to losing a lot of weight, right, in 15 weeks, to what actually you went from that to, at one point, running one of the most successful fitness businesses in Australia, and then moving into the domain of a coach. Was that about?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, like you, I was always really curious about human behavior, and I was always fascinated with this notion of success, whatever that meant. I was fascinated with possibility and potential. And when I lost all this weight, and it's not about the weight, it's about what the loss represented to me what happened was I had this, my body looked completely different. I went from the fat kid to the fit kid. I went from the non-athlete to the athlete. All that stuff, that physiological stuff was good and I enjoyed it. And all of a sudden I wasn't so socially invisible. And I think I eventually got a girlfriend, the poor girl. But what happened was-
She's still in therapy.
Still in therapy.
She's
lots
not
of
off
issues.
Her meds yet.
No, still on them. Lots of issues, all because of me. God
Tell
bless.
Us
anyway, but thanks for your support, Bobby. But what happened was when I lost all that weight- And I went from fat to fit, and I went from I can't run 500 meters to I'm running 10 Ks a day. And I'm not just running, I'm running quick. And I'm actually not a bad athlete. I'm not naturally great, but I'm actually not a bad athlete if I train and if I focus and if I apply. And then I thought, shit, all of a sudden I had this new internal reality. Like my thinking changed. And if your thinking changes, that is, if your thinking changes for the better, all of a sudden I was solution focused. All of a sudden I had a level of confidence, not arrogance, but confidence. I had curiosity. I'm like, wow, what else can I do? I had enthusiasm. I had drive. I was fascinated with.
So you were discovering signature strengths as a result of that transformation.
Yes. Yes. And I realized all this stuff about me and I realized I had this story and my story was completely fucking ridiculous. And my story was you're fat, you're useless. Think of every negative, label. They were all my labels. And it's not that I came out the other side going, wow, I'm actually fucking brilliant and gorgeous. It wasn't that. But it was, I had a moment of, even a moment of self-awareness as a teenager that I went, oh, so all those things that I thought were absolute fact, they were just stories. They were just stories. And I started to realize my potential and by extension of that, everyone's potential. And the way that my thinking got in the way. And then I started to, clearly I didn't articulate it the way that I do today, but I was fascinated with how I thought and I was fascinated with decisions and behavior. And, that was just that was a platform to get into training. I started working in gyms and, you've heard me say this too many times, but the one thing that everybody has or most people have when they go to a gym, especially for the first time, is that they're there because they want to change. They want to be different, think different, behave differently, produce different outcomes mentally, emotionally, physically, mentally, emotionally. They want to be different habits and direction and look and feel and function. And so that, within a short period of time, I realized that, look, I know not a lot, but I know the fundamentals of getting in shape, anatomy and physiology and nutrition and biomechanics and movement and energy systems. I kind of get that to a fundamental level and I can get away with that and talk about micros and macros and bums and legs. But what I don't really understand enough is I don't understand the human inside the body. So then I just did a deep dive like you. I did a deep dive on why do we do the shit that we do? Why do we think the way we do? Why do we react the way we do? Where do these stories come from? How do I change my stories? How do I help people change their story? What role does my storytelling play in terms of my ability to tap into my potential power possibilities? And understanding that really for many people in a gym setting, fitness center, whatever you want to call it, park, beach, wherever people train, wherever people exercise, that it's almost like the body wasn't really the issue. The body is really the byproduct of the issue. So for me, when I got my mind in the right place, the byproduct was there was this massive physiological shift. It's almost like my body was the consequence of the problem, not the problem itself.
So it sounds like self-efficacy is what expanded your lens. So you were able to see, okay, when this happens, then that's what creates this shift. And that gave birth to a lot of signature strengths. But I'm also hearing inspiration and the construction of a value hierarchy. And the reason why I'm saying that is because I think the difference between an authentic value and a contrived story that we tell other people to look good is when you truly value something, you don't just want it for you. that's not good enough. You want it for everybody that you come in contact with. So experiencing that transformation and understanding how the shift in your thinking showed up as a tangible outcome that changed everything about your life, that's all well and good.
Yeah. But
how do I now open up a business and give this to others? And how do I evaluate myself with a level of honesty and say, all right, what I know might've been enough to get me to this point, but it's not going to get me any further with these people because I'm not looking at the root causes. I'm looking at the human body, but not the human being that resides within it. Mm, so it's like all these things were showing up in the way I see it. It started with that self-efficacy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, one of the things that we have in our culture, which is pervasive, is this, and it's not everyone, but it's enough people where we're looking for the magic pill or the savior or the white knight or the program or the powder or the product or the what that's going to save us, fix us, change us. You know, and when you get to the point where you go, it's actually about, even if I do have good resources and, you know, support and all of those things, it still comes back to me. It still comes back to my choices and behaviors. But I was quite evangelical in the sense that I was so excited about what was happening that I've always been this. I mean, I'm 57 now and I get excited 43 years after the fat kid. I get excited talking to you about how much potential we have. Like there's nothing in me that goes, oh, fuck, I've got to do another podcast with Bobby. And by the way, for the people who don't know, Bobby and I have done 30 podcasts together in other forms, but I love it and I'm excited and I don't get sick of these conversations because what I hope is that someone is going to hear this and they're going to go, I see myself in that conversation or in Bobby or in Craig and I, or Jumbo perhaps. And I, there's, you know, something happens, but this, you know, this ability that we have and this beautiful resource that we have in 2021 for you and I to be able to have a conversation as friends, talk about shit that fascinates us anyway, this is not work. This is a privilege. This is an honor. And then we do this, we record it, push it out into the world, and maybe someone will go, fuck, that was the start of something for me, not because of Bobby, not because of Craig, but because I had a moment in time and I listened to that shit. I went away and I went, that's it. No more fucking around. No more I'm starting Monday. No more I'm starting on January 1. No more rationalizing, bullshitting. I'm not even ready, but fuck it, I'm doing it anyway. Like that, you know, for me to be able to see in people ability and potential that they don't see in themselves, I wish I could breathe it into them because I see so many people handicapping themselves because of their self-destructive, self-loathing, self-limiting inner dialogue. And then they wake up, mate, and they're 40 and they're 50 and they're just such beautiful people who don't believe in themselves. And belief can't come unless we step into the fear, unless we step into the journey and the process, because when we do the thing, then the confidence, then the awareness, then the belief grows, and then all of it fucking explodes.
That was beautiful. And there is just, out of everything you said, there's two things that really stuck out for me. One, and it's probably not the things that you would think stuck out for me. At some point in there, you said, this is not work. And we constantly are admonished. You got to do the work. You got to put in the effort. And that's like a no-brainer. But here you are. You know, I mean, let's be fair, Craig. You're one of, like, if you just looked, if somebody didn't know you and they were just observing you from afar, not in a creepy stalker sort of way, they were just looking at your daily habits, they'll say, okay, this is one of the hardest working people that I can observe. Like you're always, it seems like you're always on, you're always going. And I know that's not the case. You do stop to enjoy things. You have moments of refuge, but you're working quite hard. And here you are saying, this is not work. And I'm going, I wonder if there's something there. I think when people anticipate making a change, it's like, I know I want this thing, but there's all these other things I don't want. And as they're working towards that change, they haven't gotten that yet, because that's out in the future. And there's a lot that has to be done to cross that bridge. But while they're crossing that bridge, they're still contending with all the things they don't want. And a lot of times they lose heart, they get discouraged, their priorities and value hierarchies get in the way. And for me, it's like, well, doing what you're doing, not only what and value does it serve and who else does it serve, but for me, it's like, well, what is it in the process that makes this engaging? So I don't personally believe, and you know, I was in the health and fitness industry. I was one of the like founding directors of NASM. You know, I'm a co-founder of PTA Global. So, and I was a consultant for health club chains. So, but for me, I no longer believe that there's one right way of exercising. For me, it's like, what's the most engaging way? Like on a scale from 1 to 10 on enjoyment, you know, what you're about to do, where is it? And what are simple, subtle things that you can do to move that needle? Because if you start doing something for its own sake, because the payoff is in the process right now, not the outcome 6 months from now, it doesn't matter where you start. Even the smallest amount of shift compounds, self-efficacy grows. And when you get up in the morning because you're looking forward to exercising rather than I have to drag myself to it, you're winning. You're winning that game. And the second thing you talked about was I want to breathe it into them. And the translation, if you go back to the root of the word inspire, is to breathe life into. So there's that inspiration. I think one of the most inspiring things we can do is take something that's benefiting us and teaching other people. And so when people are in their struggle, what is it that you're learning? What is it that you've achieved? Even if you only have a 20% success rate, given your ambitions for the rest of the week, you're 20% ahead of someone who has not been able to get started. Who can you teach? Who can you support? Who wants to do something similar to what you want to do that you could be a resource for? Because once you do that, it not only shifts your perspective from student to teacher, but there is an immediate altruistic emotional reward that supports consecutive behavior. You know what I mean?
And I think also for me, the moment that I started teaching and coaching and sharing and having a purpose bigger than me, And teaching and coaching and empowering people anywhere, anytime, not because I'm at work now, this is what I need to do. It stopped being work. It stopped being a job. It never really was, but it was part of my job. But, you know, I always say to people, I tried selfishness for quite a while. I gave it a good crack. It didn't work, right? I gave selfishness a real good go, and I'm an only child and I've got issues and I've got bullshit and I've got an ego and I've got, and I tried the old self-serving thing. And I, you know, for me, the more selfish I am, which is pretty easy for me to do, the worse I am. Mm-hmm. And I don't say this to sound altruistic and special, because I'm definitely not special, but hand on heart, when I invest into others, and yes, there's got to be a line, because we don't want to exhaust ourselves and we can't be emotional doormats for others. I get all of that. But if Craig Harper's the focus of Craig Harper's life, Craig Harper's a dick and I don't like being around him. I don't like being him. But when I work to serve others genuinely and help others and be part of their support crew or whatever I can give them to help them, not do the work for them, then, you know, I grow more. I'm happier. I'm more fulfilled. And without trying to be happy or get things to make me happy or to be more fulfilled, without trying to do that, that's just a byproduct of serving others. But not serving others, look at me, I'm serving others, but actually really going deep. Like I always say,
not as a
marketing
strategy.
100%. Fuck. And you know what I hate? This is what else I hate. While I'm on my soapbox, I'm sure you hate it too. So I need to be careful how I say this because he might hear it. But anyway, if he hears it, I think you'll know we had a good talk. But, you know, people reach out to me across LinkedIn and they're like, oh, they want to, you know, I can't respond to everyone and I can't. Anyway, this guy the other day, in fact, from the States reached out and, you know, he wanted a chat with me and I don't have much time. And I said, all right, let's do a 15-minute chat, a Zoom chat. And he's like, I just want to help you. Craig, I'm here because I just want to help you. How can I help you? I'm like, okay, that's bullshit. I go, that's not why you're here. You're here because you think having a relationship with me will be advantageous to you. And I'm okay with that. I'm cool with that. But don't start with you just want to help me, right? Because you don't know me. We've never met.
So this person generated a relationship with you or generated a contact with you.
Yes.
Because he wanted it. Oh, that's rich.
Yes, yes. And that's okay. It's okay. It's almost like, what is it? What do you call that? Mentoring, connecting. What do you call that? Networking 101. You know, reach out to someone. How can I help you? How can I serve you? All that kind of stuff. And I get that too. But that's different to actually here I am with somebody. I don't know this person. We just bumped into each other. They are in pain. I have some knowledge. I have some skills. I have some empathy. I have some time. I'm just going to sit with you. I'm just going to sit with you and listen. I don't want anything. I don't want anything back. There's no hook. There's no catch. There's no agenda. I just want to give you some love. And I'm going to sit here for 10 or 20 minutes or 30 minutes and talk to you if that's what you want. And then I'm going to go. And that's it. You know, this is, for me, that's the human experience. For me, that's that deep connection with people where there is, you know, of course, you know, I do lots of things where I get paid well, as do you. And there's no guilt attached to that because I've got to make money and pay the bills. But even in the middle of that, where you're doing work and you're being paid for a consult or you're doing a gig or you're speaking to a group and this is part of your job, you can still be that person. You know, but then away from, it's like if I'm getting paid, I did a corporate gig yesterday, just like this. I was in this room. I was on this computer. I was working with an IT company. I did a one and a half hour presentation to a whole bunch of people, 15 minutes of Q&A at the end. I got paid lots of money because that's my job. It's really good. I'm very grateful. There's no ego in that. That's just what I do. Right now, today, I'm in the same room on the same computer having a conversation with one person and by extension, lots of people. And obviously there's no money exchange, but I'm just as invested and just as excited and just as passionate because this is just who I am, you know, and this is just what I do. And for me, it has to be that. It has to be. I say to the people that I work with and coach, what I care about is what you do when no one's looking. So when it's you beating your chest and telling everyone how amazing you are and how spiritual you are and how this you are, and you feel compelled to put that on Facebook, firstly, that's not very humble or spiritual. That's kind of ego. Secondly, go do all that shit and tell no one and look for no accolade, no fanfare, no trophy, no ribbon, no pat on the back. Then I'll be impressed.
Yeah, I think when people tend to overly profess something, like there's something else that's going on there. They're up to something. That could be my cynicism or that could be my past experiences. I have a really poignant and horrible story about that, but it's one of those things where this person might actually listen to this. I'm not really sure if I should go into it, but you know, I was around a business partner who used to talk about honesty and integrity. And you know, when I think about things like honesty and integrity, I don't tend to moralize them. I tend to look at them pragmatically. Like honesty to me is, it's authenticity. It's when you do not have to repress your own innate form of self-expression. And what's in you is what emanates from you in every medium of communication. So to me, that's honesty. It's not like, okay, this person's not lying, cheating, and stealing, because you know, I don't think most people do that, and some people do, but that's not my thing. And with integrity, it's just doing what you say you're going to do. when you say you're going to do it. You know, it's kind of funny because the other day somebody posted on my Facebook wall a picture of John Dillinger. And I was like, so what are you trying to tell me? You're going to go rob a bank? Like, well, what's it? He's like, oh, I think you look like John Dillinger. You remind me of John Dillinger. And my wife saw it and was like, oh yeah, definitely. Definite resemblance. And I was like, okay, I don't really know how I feel about this. Like, I remind you of Public Enemy number one and a murderer. But when you look at a guy like John Dillinger, not really a good guy per se, but he had a lot of integrity because he considered himself a bank robber and he was constantly robbing banks. Great example of this is he was surrounded by reporters one day and the reporters, they loved him. They thought he was like an anti-hero, like a folk legend. I said, well, why do you do it, Johnny? Why do you rob so many banks? And he said, well, that's where the money is. And it was just this incredibly witty, but succinct and poignant comeback where if you're a bank robber and you're robbing banks because that's where the money is, you're living in integrity. To me, integrity is doing what you say you're going to do and living authentically. Mm. That's it. That's the definition. And when you have to constantly repress that, or when you have to constantly create a construct around looking good, you're probably struggling with the thing that you're professing in the first place. And for me, it came down to a business partner who told everybody about integrity. I was involved with a group of people. And one of these people within this group, I know I'm being very vague, needed help. They really needed a lot of help. They fell into a fire, and that I'll just leave it at that. They had a seizure, fell into a fire. So the group got gathered around and provided assistance. And I had asked this person who's talking about integrity, and we helped. And this was a young child, and they basically flat out refused. But yet in a seminar, put up a picture of this kid. And so like, look at, this is what our organization does. And we help people like this. And I was just like, and I was in the back of the room. I don't think I was supposed to be there. I had gotten, I think, the times of my presentation wrong. And I was like, let me go see this. And I witnessed that. And I wasn't angry as much as I was astonished. And I felt horrible. Because you could have been the person you're talking about in the front of the room easily, but you're running this game around looking good instead.
That's right. And look, there's a couple of things that come to mind. That's a good story. And it is, sadly, that's super common. I was talking to a guy who's been on my show a bunch, and you should get him on because he's crazy and wacky, but interesting and fascinating, Jeff Jowett. And he's got a really, really interesting backstory from rags to riches to like $60 million turnover in his company that he started himself. And then, you know, drugs and booze and strippers and addiction and cocaine and parties and all that's in his words. And
sounds like
you know, we talk a lot and he's on a bit of a spiritual journey and he's opening doors and he's personally, you know, going deep on who he is and how he is and why he is like a lot of us. And I was having this conversation with him about, you know, alignment and authenticity. And I know they're overused words, but and maybe we'll come back to them in a sec, but and this is something I've had to deal with and acknowledge and be aware of and navigate is that when you are like him, he's charismatic, he's charming, he's a bit of a bogan. We would call that a bit of a redneck in the States. You know, he's a bit rough around the edges, but he's so likable and he can speak so well and so fast and he's so charming and he's so charismatic that he can fake sincerity really well, really well. And, or not that he does, but we can. And that's the thing is I can stand in front of a group and I need to, you spoke about self-efficacy before. I need to self-regulate. I need to be self-aware, you know, that because I'm used to talking and I'm used to speaking on podcasts and I'm used to being in front of groups and I don't get nervous and I've done radio and telly and a million podcasts and I know what to say and I can rely on knowledge and skill and experience and you can look like, oh, wow, that guy's really, you know, there's a difference between looking like you've got it together and being that, wow, he's so humble, he's so this, is, and playing the role. Mm-hmm. And I believe there are a lot of people, and I, if I'm being honest, I'm sure I've been that person where I play the role. Mm-hmm. And a way, you know, in fact, I can tell you a story. In my 30s, I gained a lot of weight again, and I was bodybuilding, and I was, you know, I had a lot of muscle, but I also had a lot of fat, late 20s, early 30s. And I was literally telling people to do things that I wasn't doing myself. I was talking to them about nutrition and training and lifestyle, and I was doing the opposite. I was full of shit. My ego was involved. I was embarrassed. I didn't want people to know, and I was being a fraud, right? But I knew that I could get away with it because I'd wear big baggy clothes and I'd say all the right things and I'd have all the answers. But the thing is, I was actually out of alignment. And I think this is the ever-present challenge for coaches and mentors and anyone who's in that leadership management space where they work with others is genuinely, and this is for me, it's every day it's a work because I'm flawed and fucked up and I've got issues. Every day, really, it is a work for me to overcome my ego, to overcome my self-loathing, to overcome my issues. And not in a like an overwhelming way, but just to self-regulate, because that shit's never far away. That's, you know, I can brag like that. I can cut somebody in half like that because I think so quickly. But that's not who I want to be or how I want to be. Right. But in, you know, when I was young and I would get attacked, I would slice somebody up verbally in fucking 3 seconds because that was my defense mechanism. I don't want to be that person. I don't want to be that person. And so, you know, that thing of being able to, you know, with others, and I think this really is important. And the reason that I point out my flaws is not because I'm self-loathing or looking for attention, but because I think when people go or realize, so Craig Harper, who has written a bunch of books and done some cool things and has done okay, he's mildly successful, he does all right, and he's kind of like me. Like, he overthinks and he gets anxious and he gets a bit depressed every now and then, and he's got self-doubt and he feels sometimes like a fraud. Then all of a sudden people go, well, fuck, I'm a version of Craig Harper, or he's a version of me. And I think what that does when people see somebody like you, who's one of the best speakers I've ever seen in my life, and I've said that for 20 years, you know, but I also know that you have your struggles. I also know that you and I have some deep and meaningful conversations where we're both going deep on our own bullshit, trying to figure stuff out. You know, but that doesn't mean we can't step up and have a conversation like this where we're sharing thoughts and ideas and strategies, but still be the human. Like, don't aspire to be like me, for God's sake.
And by we, I don't mean me and you. I mean everybody a combination of incredibly inspiring attributes and shocking, like, instances of just colossal fuck ups. And we're all this person. One of the best frames for this that I've ever heard was from a CEO that I worked with not too long ago. And he just had this concept of originating intention. And you've heard me talk about this because it completely allowed me to frame my world in a different way, a very constructive way, and share that. And originating intention is something that you hold sacred. Like, this is critically important for you. When you are engaged in this thing, whatever it is, those are the moments when you truly feel most alive, and you want it for everybody else with no condition. Not, I want it for them if they think like me, if they're part of my political ideology, if they do the work and they've earned it. No, I want it for everybody. And so when you operate from that space, you become that thing that's sacred for you. And then there's, on the other end, the shadow. and the way we were taught to identify our shadow is, you know, what do you say to yourself? For me, it was volatile. What do you say to yourself when you know someone who you really love, someone who's important to you, is about to fail you, is about to fail you massively. And it's not an accidental failure. It's an intentional act of betrayal. What do you say to yourself? And that a lot of times is when you feel threatened at that level, is when the ego shows up and you're that shadow. And basically the ego shows up in one of two ways. One is a superiority complex. The other one's an inferiority complex. Like my coach, you know, called me out on it. He said, you know, the reason why you're struggling in this moment and the reason why you need to get the fuck out of this room until you sort yourself out is because your ego is out of control. He's like, you walk in here and you're like, oh, you know, I'm not as smart as everybody else here. I'm struggling with this. He's like, you're under the impression that anything going on in this room right now has anything to fucking do with you. You're not that, you are not that important to what's going on here. So he's like, when you walk into a room and you point and you're self-deprecating beyond humor to the point of bringing people's attention to it, you're no different than the person who walks into a room thinking, I'm the most talented person in this room. You're the same person, different expression. And that really hit me hard because I really, oh wow, I've got some issues with my ego. And it's usually when you are feeling like you're not enough or you're threatened. But when you have these two opposing compasses, a compass that directs you where you don't want to go, and the person driving that vehicle is someone you don't want to be, versus a direction towards originating intention, which not only makes you feel alive, but if anything, it has an efficacious, a positive impact on people around you. And for me, those are those two twin poles in my behavior, my personality, my shadow, and my originating intention. So for me, that's been extremely powerful. So, you know, as we're coming to an end of this, because we could do like a 5-hour podcast, just sitting down, having a casual chat. If somebody's listening to this right now, which I assume is probably everybody, unless there's just an incredibly well-adjusted, contented person listening and well done there. And they're wanting to take a step and make a transformation that for whatever reason hasn't worked out for them, or they haven't even begun yet. It's an intention, but they haven't put it into action. What's the best advice you can give them? And on the flip side of that, what's the worst advice they can listen to?
Okay. So this is not in order of importance. And obviously that's a question without notice. So I'm just going to say that
we're on the fly here.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't get the questions. Did you email them to me? Okay. So when we want to change something, and I assume that everyone listening to this will have at least one thing in their life about them, thinking, habits, behaviors, outcomes, situation, circumstance, environment, body, relationships, whatever, something that they want to change. So I think a really good starting point is to, you know, without getting all typical, you know, what is it that you want to change? Why do you want to change it? Right. That's a good place to start. But also to recognize that everything that we want to change, whether or not that's lose weight, build muscle, build a brand, do a PhD, write a book, create a great relationship, move to another state, you know, reinvent yourself academically or something. Everything that we want to do or create or change comes at a price. That could be time, that could be effort, that could be energy, that could be fear that you've got to step into, that could be money, that could be resources, that could be that a relationship needs to end or a new one needs to start or whatever it is. But everything comes at a price. And I think as much as possible, you know, what fuels the desire to change usually is emotion. Like I get excited at the idea of doing a PhD. Well, let me tell you, the excitement, the idea of doing a PhD is a far fucking cry from the practical reality of doing one, right? And so, you know, so there's the thing that fuels us, which is the passion, the motivation, the inspiration, the excitement, the enthusiasm. But then as quickly as possible, we go, cool. Now that excitement, motivation, inspiration is going to fade to some level, maybe totally within the next hour or the next week or month or whatever. So then is to quickly wrap strategy around it. and say, cool, this is what I want to do. What's my plan? What's my strategy? What's my structure? What's my accountability system? What's my timeline? Just like we have projects at work and we manage projects and we manage money and we manage businesses and we manage careers and we manage our kids and we manage all these things. If you're really interested in changing something about you or how you do life, turn that into a project. Turn down the emotion, turn up the strategy, turn up the logic. You know, sometimes the price is I need to get uncomfortable every day for the next 100 days. And by the way, I'm addicted to comfort. So that's a challenge. Well, that's cool. So my question then is, will you get uncomfortable? Because if you won't, then conversation over.
So you need to be brutally honest with yourself about the price that you're going to have to pay. And then you have to ask yourself, am I willing to pay this full price in advance?
100%. And even zoning, even, you know, stepping back even further, Bobby, go, okay, if now, and this is not about self-loathing, everyone. This is about self-awareness. So for me, for example, this is what I needed to do when I was about 30. I can't actually remember. I'm going to go mid-30s, 20 years ago. I had to go, you know what, Craig, you actually have a fucking eating disorder. Yeah, you're smart-ish, you're educated, you know a lot about food and training and humans and thinking, and you know all of that, but guess what? You yourself, Craig, you have a problem. So I had to acknowledge my problem and go, I have somewhere on the scale between eating issues and an eating disorder, or perhaps disordered eating, doesn't matter, semantics really for me. And I had to acknowledge that I, you know, so for me, exercise, not a problem, sleep, lifestyle, drugs, alcohol, no issues. But for me, it's always been food. And I've had a toxic, unhealthy, destructive relationship with food, and I've lied about food and I've hidden my food behaviors. And I've lived contrary to my own messages that I'm sharing with people and so on. And again, this is just about going, yeah, okay, I don't want to be that or do that anymore. And, you know, the truth is that if everybody listening to this right now could think of one thing that they really want to change, one thing, don't overthink it. Don't start to rationalize why today's not the time or it's inconvenient, because that's always going to be the case. Because success and change and transformation is inconvenient as fuck. So if you're after convenience, fucking let it go. If you're after comfort, let it go. If you're after certainty, let it go, right? Because it doesn't happen. Because the transformative process, for the most part, at least for a while, is uncertain, uncomfortable, unpredictable, unfamiliar, and not fun. Sorry to be the bearer of bad tidings, but that's going to be for a while. Eventually that changes, it comes around and we step into, you know, the fun stuff. But initially, you got to remember that all of us, consciously or not, and I know I'm banging on, but right now, all of us have got our own rules and rituals and habits, and all of those things are hardwired into our cognitive and behavioral default setting. That's just fucking, this is how I do life. This is how I do food. This is how I do lifestyle. This is how I do relationships. This is how I do God. This is me. And if all of that's working optimally, then fucking great, change nothing. But if it's not, identify what's not working, identify the cost of changing it, and fully fucking commit. Fully commit to the process. Throw away the get out of jail card, lose the escape clause, and completely commit to doing that thing, whether it's comfortable, uncomfortable, easy, quick, painless, or not. And that's a nice start.
So what would be the worst advice somebody could take?
The worst advice would be to wait for the right time. The worst advice would be to look for the shortcut, the quick fix, the pill. And the worst advice would be, and I know this is not one thing, but to keep waiting for that person to come and fix you, save you, transform you. So many people are looking for a savior. They need to go look in the mirror.
Thank you, Craig. It's sadly, thanks, mate. We are out of time, but we got a ton of value. If somebody's taking notes right now, I'm not saying you are, but if you were, I'm sure there's a lot of key points that people took from this or taken from this. So thanks a lot, mate. Really appreciate having you.
Pleasure, mate. Good luck with the podcast.